Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jonathan Lethem, who reads from and discusses his wickedly funny new novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, published by Doubleday. In the weeks to come, we have Sarah Davidson, Craig Childs, Michael Chabon, Elizabeth Berg, Deepak Chopra, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. Jonathan Lethem is a genius, something readers in this audience no doubt knew well before the MacArthur Foundation bestowed the Genius Award to him in 2005. We probably knew it with whichever one of his six novels or short stories or essays we picked up first, be it Motherless Brooklyn or As She Climbed Across the Table or Fortress of Solitude. Now, in his latest novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, genius itself is a character in a way in this great novel that explores issues of theft, plagiarism, originality, and appropriation, themes that he wrote about in a recent article for Harper's, which begins with a John Donne quote, "All mankind is of one author and is one volume. When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language, and every chapter must be so translated." Towards the end of the novel, one of his characters notes of the band within the novel, Monster Eyes was their final name. Theirs, quote, was a band whose secret genius had a secret genius. In fact, it is of note that I took this hint from a review in the Village Voice. These themes also coincide with Jonathan's Promiscuous Materials project, which you can discover on his website, jonathanlethem.com, where some of his stories are up for filmmakers or dramatists to adapt, and they are available non-exclusively for $1 apiece. We are delighted to welcome him back to the Tattered Cover, and as we were just talking, he's been here several times, and we're just so glad to have him back. Please welcome Jonathan Lethem. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming out on a creepy night out there. I think snow in late April is creepy. And thanks for the great introduction. That was very nice. Although all that talk about genius and appropriation and all that serious stuff makes it sound all very intimidating. And this book is a big, silly, romantic farce, actually. No heavy mental effort required. I'm going to read from pretty late in You Don't Love Me Yet. This is a book about a kind of hopeless rock band in Los Angeles. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay. And they're, you know, for most of the book, they're the kind of band that rehearses but never has a gig and spends a lot of its energy trying to decide what the name of the band should be. And of course, doing their day jobs and having complicated romantic lives. So it's not exactly like an insightful glimpse into the music industry or anything. It's not a book that tells you anything about the lives of working musicians in that sense, because these guys never get to that place. But they do almost get there just for a moment in the book. And it's a band of four 20-somethings, two women and two men. And they're, you know, in their bumbling way, they come into this one song, which for one brief shining moment seems like it's a great song, and people love it and are going to love them as a result of this, and they play it at a big party in a loft, and the song is called Monster Eyes, and after they play this song, Monster Eyes, and everyone loves it, everyone is confused and decides that must also be the name of the band, so suddenly they seem to be named Monster Eyes as well. And this is all great, and they get invited to be on Los Angeles's top radio station, and this radio station is one where this guy named Fancher Autumn Breast has a radio show where the reputation is that if, you know, he invites you to come and play live on his show, you're made. That's it. You're golden. And Fancher Autumn Breast is this sort of bohemian legend. This guy, you know, gray-haired 60s hipster who, you know, hung out with Marianne Faithfull and maybe did or didn't have a fling with, you know, with all sorts of various great female rock stars. And they're quite intimidated by Fancher Autumn Breast, but he hears Monster Eyes, he's at the party, and he loves them. So he invites them onto the show. The problem is that by the time of this scene, I'm going to read you the radio appearance of the band. By the time they get to the radio show, something appalling has happened to the band, and that is that this guy named Carl the Complainer has kind of inserted himself into their lineup. And Carl the Complainer is this very kind of bullying, charismatic, strange man who, for reasons that are too complicated to explain now, has a kind of claim on these guys. And so he decides he should be in the band, and they, being hapless 20-somethings, they don't know how to resist. So they turn up at the radio station for their big appearance, and now that this guy, Carl the Complainer, is in the band. The radio station's unglamour was sobering. No one would have pictured Fancher Autumn Breast, paragon of bohemian taste, amid the bland commercial edifices and slickly nostalgic boutiques and dozy, off-brand policemen of Culver City. The band stood assembled in the vanilla-carpeted lobby of the station's studio as if dragged into the day's light for a medical procedure. Their misspelled names checked off in an appointment book by an unimpressed receptionist. They were led upstairs and abandoned to a green room full of surfing and cigar magazines, bottled water, and a wicker cornucopia full of bruised grapes, coagulated brie, and sesame crackers. "I'd like to explode this place with a bomb, if it could be okay to say that." "You need to build up your immunity. If we rocket to the top, it'll require a series of compromises with antiseptic environments like this one." "Shouldn't we have brought spray paint or a television set to push out a window?" "I don't think you're supposed to destroy a television set at a radio station." They glimpsed Fancher Autumn Breast only momentarily, a figure in a gray sweatsuit with orange piping. He hailed them with a vigorous bout of silent winking and finger snapping through a large window as they set up their instruments in a crowded booth. Only the Complainer seemed free of the pall that eclipsed the group, the apprehension that they were the wrong band with the wrong song. They feared that they might be unready. Or the opposite. They might be overpracticed, fallen out of sync, and had ruined the song. Maybe they'd gotten out of the wrong sides of their beds. Wasn't 4 in the afternoon, anyway, a famous energy sink, a vortex of enervated human attention? Who would listen to the song? Who would care? Matthew and Bedwin plinked at their instruments, testing microphone levels for the engineer on the far side of the glass. A blasé goth girl with lank black hair and a nocturnally pale complexion. Her own mic channel bled into their booth. Ceaseless, incomprehensible, staticky asides directed to unseen others. Now Fancher Autumn Breast made his looming passage into the booth. He squinted his mournful brow as if across some great distance, though the tiny booth barely contained him and the band. Despite the tracksuit, he gave off traces of patchouli and clove, redolent smoke. Shaking his leonine head and showing the slightest of smiles, he embraced Matthew. Then he reached for Lucinda, kissing each cheek and tipping her elegantly, fingertips at the small of her back. Bedwin he chucked under the chin. Bedwin blushed. Autumn Breast then blew a kiss to Denise, his gesture fulsome. The four band members quivered slightly, puppyish under his hand. "Oh, you dizzy kids," said Autumn Breast. He squinted one eye. The band waited, enspelled. Finally, Autumn Breast lifted his chin at the Complainer, who stood grinning at his keyboard. "Who he?" he asked Matthew. "New band member," said the Complainer, sticking out his hand. "Carl's the name." Autumn Breast squinted more deeply, suggesting the Complainer was difficult to make out, a form vanishing in wavering heat lines on far asphalt. "Hmm," he said. "Yes?" said the Complainer. "Fifth Beatle," said Autumn Breast. 10 minutes, warned the buzzing voice of the engineer. Autumn Breast widened his hands. Everybody beautiful? They gawped, perplexed. You're mic'd? They're mic'd, the engineer cut in. Then you're beautiful, said Autumn Breast. Except you, Beetle. What do you do? Play this keyboard, sir. Sing? I do, sir. Autumn Breast shook his head, sighed. Goof, he said. Sorry? You heard me, Beetle. Autumn Breast repeated the word silently, as in a game of charades, pointing from himself to the complainer. I think I understand, said Carl. 7 minutes, said the engineer. Are we being interviewed? Interrupted Denise, speaking in her confusion for the whole band. Or just playing the song? Yes. Yes what? This gig's easy, Pumpkin. I tickle you and you laugh. Excuse me? Be organic, said Autumn Breast, pained to explain. Just speak into your mics, explained the engineer. Try not to pop your plosives or say fuck or shit. I probably ought to get a quick sound check to balance the instruments, Mr. Autumn Breast. The complainer now raised his hand. Sir? Yes, Beetle? Our guitarist needs a chair. Chair? Bedwin nodded shamefully. And, the complainer went on, I think I'd prefer to lie on the floor. Are you sick? Asked Denise. No, it's for the song, said Carl. Can we put the microphone on the floor? You want to sing on the floor? Said Matthew. I need to sing on the floor, yes. You won't be able to play the keyboard, said Denise. You don't need me on keyboard. No one could argue the point. I need to be on the floor to get the right emotion, said the complainer. I've just had a realization that I wasn't giving the band my all. Art requires sacrifice, even of one's dignity. 6 minutes, said the engineer. I better get a sound check. Everyone waited for Autumn Breast, who said at last, Mike Beetle on the floor, morsel. Thank you, said Carl. And a chair for Bedwin. And a chair. The engineer Autumn Breast had called Morsel tramped from behind her instrument panel, through the rubber-sealed doors, which opened with a sound like a sneeze, and into the sound booth. She brought a chair and rearranged the complainer's mic stand, loosening the hinge and capsizing the microphone so it hovered a few inches from the carpet. She was pure efficiency, a human clock ticking toward their on-air deadline. The band could only watch, reduced to an autistic helplessness. Fancher Autumn Breast sat cross-legged against the lip of the booth's window, bridging his forehead with his fingers, radiating philosophical detachment from all present events. Try this, said Morsel. The complainer threaded his sneakered feet through Denise's kit, laid his right arm under Lucinda's mic stand, and settled his bulk across the cables that ribboned the carpet. Morsel scurried past Autumn Breast, through the sound-sealed door, and reseated at her control panel. Autumn Breast revealed no trace of urgency. His wide hands now fully masked his face, thumb and fingertips over his eyes, Hamlet with a headache. 3 minutes, said Morsel. Everybody want to give me a little something? First, the person on the floor. I'm the man who wrote Monster Eyes, began the complainer from the floor, in falsetto, as if improvising a new song about himself. Okay, that's fine, interrupted Morsel. Lead vocal, I got your levels already. Chair guy, play a chord or two. The engineer circumnavigated the room, eliciting twangs and mumbles. Fair enough, sounds good. Mr. Autumn Breast, we should probably get you into the booth. Autumn Breast turned and looked at her as if startled. 1 minute, sir, said Morsel apologetically. Sure, said Autumn Breast, coming out of his trance. Okie doke, kittens. This is radio. The band waited to understand. You won't see me, said Autumn Breast, but I'm with you, all over and through you. Oh, yes, said Morsel. Give them the pep talk. Pep talk? Yes, they're nervous, I believe. Okie doke, said Autumn Breast. Listen, million bands have done the jaw. Here's what I say. Secret to radio is think of your favorite person. Got a favorite person? Alex Chilton, said Bedwin. Autumn Breast winced. Only think, not say. Sorry. Chilton set fire to my wallet, mused Autumn Breast. Paris, 1974. Marianne was there, trying to impress her. 30 seconds, sir, said Morsel. You were saying think of our favorite person, nudged Matthew. Sure, Dandelion, favorite person. When you talk, pretend you're them. Only it can't be me, because that's who I'm pretending to be. The booth, sir. Autumn Breast offered them one last expansive gaze, then swept out. Silence enveloped the room. Even Morsel's buzzing dimmed as she bore down on her instrument panel. Denise tightened the wingnut on her lone cymbal, her brow furrowed, presenting musicianly integrity in the face of any circumstance. Bedwin appeared to be licking or gnawing his frets. Matthew postured at his mic stand, perhaps attempting to recapture an attitude essential to putting the song across. The complainer lay with his eyes closed, possibly asleep. His shirt gaped at the buttons, permitting sproutage of unruly hairs. He looked essential, sexual, a fist-like ruddy bulb planted in the garden of the band. 3, 2, 1, counted Morsel softly. Welcome, came Fancher Autumn Breast's voice. As he'd promised them, he was invisible, yet everywhere at once. He purred through the room, intoned in their bodies like a bass line. Back. Me jaw, you dreaming. Wide awake dreaming. So, here. Guests. Rare debut. Silver Lake. Echo Park. Friends. We've heard. You'll hear. They're playing. For you. Live. They were four. Now they're five. Changes already. Into the silence that followed came the profound, ear-ringing emptiness of outer space. Monster eyes, said Fancher Autumn Breast. Real sweetheart people. Talk to Los Angeles, monster eyes. Nobody spoke. When, bunny rabbits? Where? Names, influences. Are you recording or touring? Starting with Matthew and ending with Carl, they each spoke their names, gave faltering hellos and thank yous. Met how? Matthew and I were working at a copy shop together. She and Denise played in a band in school. We always thought Bedwin was so talented. I dialed a number I found stickered on a payphone. The song, interrupted Autumn Breast. They were stopped again. Big party. Major scene. Everybody there. Slayed the crowd. People talking. Yes, it's ironic, actually, because we were originally meant to play silently. Played it twice. First time, ecstasy. Second time, fear. Sorry? I fear you, monster eyes. Thanks a lot. That really means a lot to us, coming from you. Who? What? Wrote it. The anthem. The howl. Simultaneously, Bedwin said, Lucinda. Lucinda said, Carl. And Denise said, Bedwin. The complainer from the floor said nothing. Group mind, that's who. Unfetter your charisma, said Autumn Breast. Los Angeles is suffering to hear you, monster eyes. Sorry, said Matthew. Sing your song. First, I want to explain something, said the complainer from the floor. Before we sing, if that's okay. Newest member, said Autumn Breast. Lucky man. I do feel lucky, yes. Thank you, said the complainer. On the studio floor, like a drowned eagle. That's what I wanted to explain, said Carl. It came to me today that Monster Eyes is really a song about death. The singer of the song is a sort of zombie, issuing a warning to the living. Zombie? Monster Eyes is really the force that degrades every living thing, said the complainer. When you look at the world or another person through Monster Eyes, you're sensing the putrefaction in beautiful things. The spoiled vegetables and tumors and decaying teeth. The funky odors that cling even to babies and beautiful women. The band was frozen. Lucinda spoke as if in a nightmare to intervene. I think what Carl means is that when you don't love someone, you're prone to... There's a certain kind... Some things don't. Sorry, said Lucinda. Autumn Breast hadn't finished his thought. He continued, Need saying... I'm not entirely sure we ought to play this song anymore, said the complainer. Maybe since we've come all this way, just one last time. But we should sing it honestly, like zombies. since it's a zombie song. Autumn Breast's Oz-like voice now emitted that sole syllable with which he'd earlier indicted the complainer in person. "Goof," he said. "That's why I'm lying on the floor," said Carl, "so I can give it a more sepulchral, voice-from-the-grave kind of feeling." Denise had been silent since speaking her name. Now she raised her sticks and ticked off the song's beat, voting for a musical escape from their interview. It was what Autumn Breast had requested, after all, their song. Bedwin fell in, lightly riffing the chord. It wasn't the intro they'd rehearsed, but the song's form was recognizable, though threadbare. Lucinda curled two fingers down to flesh the ghost-like song with her bass line. The complainer began to bark out the song's first lyrics, Matthew's opening lines, only in a garbled and deranged form. Better conceal yourself from the light, ooh, my little pumpkin. There are things that come out at night, and they come out galumphin'. I'm the one who'll always cut you down to size, excavating your flaws with my monstrous eyes, woo! The microphone morsel had set on the floor was well-placed, capturing the complainer's every hissed sibilant. Wait. Denise quit the beat, so the music unspooled. Bedwin's chords were reduced to choppy nonsense. Carl, what are you doing? Well, that's Matthew's part, and you're singing it wrong. I'm improvising. Flat on the floor, as if gazing at clouds, the complainer remained blithe. It was as though they were trying to wake a dreamer, demanding he rise and walk. Or maybe the rest of them, destroying their chances on live radio, late for the party that was meant to be their lives, gone to school without pants. Maybe they were the dreamers. "Let's try again," said Lucinda, hopelessly. "Matthew, maybe if just you sing." Denise ticked at her drum again, daring them to follow. Lucinda thrummed the bass figure. Bedwin, though, had cinched both feet on the lip of his chair, knees twinned as though to protect his guitar from attack. Autumn Breast's voice was conspicuous in its absence now, and no sign, encouraging or otherwise, came from Morsel. "Carl, will you promise not to come in before Matthew?" said Denise. "I promise to embrace the song and everything I feel," said Carl, "and everything you feel, too." He lay immobile, his belly rising and falling with his breath. His voice filled the room, seeming endless, self-sustaining, horrible. "Maybe we should sing it a cappella," he continued, "or recite it like a one-act play, which might help bring out the drama in the words." Dr. Marion came through the door and stood spotlit in the band's midst. "Okay, I'd better explain. Dr. Marion is the veterinary director of the Los Angeles Zoo. Now you understand. As if you read the book, you'll see there's various things to do with the zoo going on in this book. But what's important here is that in a stray moment, Lucinda, the bass player, has impulsively asked Dr. Marion, who has a very kind of commanding presence, to become the band's manager, never believing she would say yes. And now here she is. Dr. Marion came through the door and stood spotlit in the band's midst. Her prow-like chest and chin, her front heavy bun of hair, nearly a pompadour, her flashing, careworn eyes, all demanded their absolute attention. "Mr. Plangent," Dr. Marion said. "Miss Hoke." No one spoke. "I begin to see the problem."
"You do?" said Lucinda.
"Yes, it's unmistakable," said Dr. Marion. "Carl, am I saying your name right?"
"That's my name. Who are you?"
"That's not important right now. May I see you outside, Carl?" The complainer flounced on the tiles, his white hair sloppy, his posture poor even lying on his back, taking up uncommon amounts of space and air. Dr. Marion stood, bullet-like, arms crossed under her breasts, monitor challenging Merrimack.
"Do I have to?" Carl said at last.
"Yes," said Dr. Marion. "You've come to an end here, Carl."
"If you say so."
"I do."
"You're a hard woman to refuse."
A certain lascivious quality flickered in Carl's tone, pointlessly. He batted his lids at her, upside down.
"Don't flatter yourself," said Dr. Marion. "You don't know me that well."
"I'm sorry." Apology accepted. She pointed at the door. Carl giggled feebly. Dr. Marion was less the band's new manager than a figure of death, it seemed to Lucinda. The complainer had evoked the word, and she'd come in black to collect him. Now he squirmed onto his stomach and crawled from amid the band's equipment, making a path around Matthew's mic stand. Dr. Marion held open the rubber-sealed door. The complainer remained on all fours, his expression that of a supplicant. She offered a curt nod as he passed over the threshold and continued down the corridor. Dr. Marion went after him with a crisp air of unfinished business. The door sealed behind her. The room was restored to silence, underlined by the ambient hum of their amplified, unplayed guitars. Morsel sat silent, framed at her console in the control room. She met them with a level, not unfriendly gaze. Matthew coughed resoundingly, his back to the others. The coils of Denise's snare rattled in sympathy with the cough. Lucinda swayed her hips and instrument rightward, filling some of the space the complainer had vacated. It was as if they'd come to this room without him. They were a foursome again, a band utterly changed by having accommodated the complainer, yet embarrassingly still themselves. Denise fixed at her set, emanating resolve, Bedwin clinging to his instrument's neck for solace, Matthew infinitely damaged and proud, Lucinda negotiating between, medium for the band's yearning and confusion, their bass player. Denise now stirred them with a beat, metronomically clean. Lucinda fitted her bass notes around the drum's tick. Bedwin joined too, his chords a perfect emanation from his hiding place. Matthew met the song at the first pass. Lucinda had never heard him sing this way. She thought she heard a measure of the complainer's tormented yawp in his approach, as though he'd subsumed Carl's voice in his own. It didn't matter. It was the best they'd ever played. Morsel tiptoed out when no one was looking. So when they finished, they were entirely alone. Autumnbreast didn't speak if he was listening. It was hard to believe he'd heard. No one congratulated them. No one was on the line. No one had broadcast or bootlegged their small, enraptured song. They waited in the booth in dumb embarrassment until Morsel reappeared. She offered them release forms, which they signed without reading. "We weren't on the radio, were we?" "Just the first part of the interview," said Morsel. "After that, the station went to a cart, a pre-recorded feature on Mr. Autumnbreast's charitable work with rescued greyhounds, including his own companion animal, Verve. But not the song." "Not the song," she confirmed. "Thank you. Good luck." Matthew walked Lucinda out. Denise and Bedwin were already gone. Lucinda's car was where she'd left it, but Carl had her key. They abandoned it, rode in an elevator to the top of a parking garage to Matthew's Mazda, and loaded Lucinda's bass into the back seat. He turned the key in the ignition, then stopped, staring across the roof at a tall figure folding his legs into a small sports car. They walked over. Fancher Autumnbreast seemed to wait for them. There was no companion animal in the car. "Pretty," said Autumnbreast, once Lucinda and Matthew stood at his driver's window. His expression was fond and wounded. "Sorry? You're pretty." "We wanted to apologize." Autumnbreast lifted his hands from the wheel, shut his eyes. "Will you have us back on the show?" Autumnbreast blinked, tried to find words. "Who?" "Us," they said. "Monster Eyes." Autumnbreast smiled forgivingly. "What you saw in us before," said Matthew, it can't be completely gone." Autumnbreast raised a fist as though in solidarity, curled it to his own lips, and kissed each of his four knuckles, his eyes again gently lidded. "Are you saying it is gone?" said Lucinda. Autumnbreast sighed, seeming to wish they could interpret his gnomic gesture and spare themselves the squalor of mere language. Seeing their wide, waiting eyes, he spoke. "It's so gone, Buttermilk, it's like it was never there." Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Sarah Davidson, Craig Childs, Michael Chabon, Elizabeth Berg, Deepak Chopra, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on April 24th, 2007.